Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Mike Florio is our regular guest at this regular time, 10 o'clock on a Wednesday. You can follow him on Twitter at Pro Football Talk. He is, of course, of the website Pro Football Talk and NBC Sports. Mike, great to have you. Nice to talk with you. What, in the name of all that is holy, is going on with the Colts and Andrew Luck's migrating foot or leg or something? What's going on here?
Yeah, I said last night, trying to figure out Andrew Luck's current injury has turned into a game of three-card Monty. I mean, it's gone from calf strain to bone issue to high ankle issue. And you would think in this day and age, look, if I have something wrong with my car, I take it to the shop, they plug it into a machine, and they know instantly what's wrong with it. You got a guy making $25 million a year working for a $1 billion business, and it takes them months to even begin to get to the bottom of what is wrong with him. It really is astounding to me. And the bigger picture is Andrew Luck's been on a roller coaster since 2015. He played in seven games that year due to injury, 15 the next, zero the next, 16 last year, and now the roller coaster is going in the other direction. And he's going to be 30 in September. You just have to wonder what kind of long-term durability he's going to have and what kind of long-term decisions the Colts are going to have to make about a guy who, when he plays, is a top-five talent. But if he can only play a full season every other year, and he's going to miss more than half of the season every other year beyond that, you got to wonder how much longer the Colts are going to ride with Andrew Luck.
You know, Mike, the curiosity on this one, I'm sure they are thrilled that it is his leg and not his shoulder, because we know what that cost him a year and a half, and obviously was back 100% from that last year. You almost wonder on this one if they are as concerned as we all are, because it is the leg, and it may just be that it's not worth pushing it in the preseason. Is anything you're hearing suggesting that this is something they're worried about carrying over deep into the season?
Well, I haven't heard anything specific that they are worried about it carrying over deep into the regular season, but look at the circumstances. He's practiced three times since April. They gave him the off-season program basically off. When he came back for training camp, they declared that he was good to go, and then within a couple of days, he was missing practices again. So unless and until they pinpoint the cause of it and come up with a way to make that pain go away, you know, the pain is the body telling the mind, stop what you're doing or I'm going to full out revolt against you and something's going to give here. And that's why they've been going easy with it. Frank Reich has said he was influenced by what happened with Kevin Durant, his calf injury that became a torn Achilles. So they've been careful about it. And you know, the key is figuring out what's causing it and then coming up with a solution. It's astounding it's taken them this long to figure out that that's what the issue is. And now the question is, how long is it going to take to get it fixed? But you have to be concerned about him missing regular season time at this point. We're only 3.5 weeks away from their first game against the Chargers.
Talking with Mike Florio here on the Bernstein and McKnight Show. I'm Connor. Hub Arkish is in for Dan. You know, locally and here covering the Bears, as Hub does, I like to check in every now and again on the just kind of the national viewpoint on some of the things that are seemingly every day for Bears fans here in town. Yet, I think getting a wide perspective is kind of a good thing every now and again. How are you reading some of the things Matt Nagy has said about kind of pulling back on the offense and making sure that the install goes, I suppose, the way it needs to for everybody involved as they go from 101 to 202?
I mean, here is the challenge that the Bears are going to face. Every team that they will be confronting this season has had an opportunity to go back and look at year one of Matt Nagy and Mitchell Trubisky, and where are the weaknesses? How do we make them do things they don't want to do? What do we take away? How do we defend this? And so for Matt Nagy and Mark Helfrich and Mitchell Trubisky, the challenge is, how do we take it to the next level? How do we counter what they're going to do? And I think that you have to expect a certain amount of difficulty that results from the 17 games of film that are out there from last year, and how do you innovate? How do you push behind it? How do you build on what you did last year? And, you know, how much of that offense is just so good it doesn't matter if the defense has a specific scheme aimed at taking certain things away. Just physically, the Bears are good enough to execute it, and as Mitchell Trubisky develops, I think that's really the key. Can he develop into a guy who can take advantage of the openings that will be available as the defense swarms based upon film study toward the things that they think they can pounce on to try to confuse and confound Mitchell Trubisky. And his ability to run that offense, play in and play out, game in, game out, drive in and drive out, that's going to be the key factor in whether or not the Bears' offense can continue on a positive trajectory.
You know, Mike, such a big part of this season, you just threw an interesting turn of phrase there, how much of that offense is just so good. I think another interesting question about this team is how much of that defense is just so good that if the Bears can improve the running game, which was a big focus during the offseason, that's going to open up things that these other defenses, opposing defenses, have not prepared for. And I'm curious what you're hearing about that defense, because it looks to be just the most talented group in the world, and so the switch from Fangio to Pagano shouldn't be that big a deal. But a switch of defensive coordinators usually is a big deal. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, not that Vic Fangio was at the level of Buddy Ryan, but to the extent that people are going to compare this defense to the 85 Bears, it's the equivalent of Buddy Ryan walking out the door after 1984. What do you do in 1985? In comes Chuck Pagano. How much of the system is he going to retain? How much is he going to do what they did last year? How much needs to be learned? How much more quickly or slowly will that adjustment be made? But when you're talking about just having an incredible collection of talented players at every level of the defense, you know, the scheme will work out itself when those guys can just go out and do what they need to do and react to what they see and use that physical ability to win the challenges of the line of scrimmage when it's time for Khalil Mack to be disruptive and then the linebackers flowing to the ball and the defensive backs covering. You know, there's only so much on the defensive side of the ball where scheme comes into play. If you just have great athletes all over the place, they're going to find a way to shut down an offense.
Well, and guys, just because I'm so old, this will make Bears fans feel better. The, quote, 85 Bears defense actually set the record at the time for fewest points allowed in a season in 86 in Vince Tobin's first year after Buddy left.
Right.
But again, it was because of the great talent, and that defense did have some issues going forward that weren't fixed. Eventually, you know, Vince moved on.
Hey, Mike, I'm wondering, after one, you know, week of preseason football, as it was, what are your thoughts on how the refereeing crews did on the instant replay of pass interference?
Well, look, I think for the most part, Al Riveron got these calls right. There was one in the Jets-Giants game that when you watch it five times, you see why he dropped the flag remotely for pass interference, because there was a grabbing of the receiver's wrist. I just want the bar to be a little bit higher. I want it to be like what we saw at the Chiefs-Bengals game on Saturday night, where Byron Pringle, the Chiefs receiver, got wiped out by a defensive back before the ball arrived. That's the Tommy Lee Lewis, Mikel Roby Coleman play. And I just want it to be something where you don't have to watch it three times. You don't have to put it in slow motion. You can tell right away that a mistake was made. So that for the most part, was encouraging. The one new issue that flickered for me, it came in that same Chiefs-Bengals game. It was a review of potential offensive pass interference initiated by the replay booth in the final 2 minutes of the first half. And Byron Pringle, same guy who had the pass interference earlier in that drive that wasn't called but was called by replay review, he puts a hand on the helmet of Darius Phillips of the Bengals and shoves to gain separation, but he didn't catch the pass. And I think if he caught the pass, the flag would have been dropped for offensive pass interference. I think Al Riveron is taking into account the outcome of the play, the circumstances, what it means to the team, if I call it, if I don't call it. And I know that's human nature, but they need to iron that out. You should not be making those decisions based upon what happened on the play. It's either interference or it's not. And it was clear pass interference offensively. And I'm convinced if Pringle would have caught that pass, Riveron would have called for offensive pass interference in that instance.
You know, Mike, we haven't talked in a while, and I'm curious if you're in the same place that I am on this, because I understand the emotion of the moment, the anger of Saints fans, all of that. I get why these rule changes were made. The league felt they had to do something. But I'm in the camp of firmly believing that the unintended consequences of this change are going to be a disaster, and they're kind of twofold. One is all the other things we're going to see in these replays that were or weren't called that aren't getting fixed, and two, and maybe more importantly, and it's kind of in line with what you were just talking about, the two penalties that no two officials call the same are pass interference and holding. And so I just think that, you know, no matter what they end up as their kind of rule of thumb, I think as much negative as positive is going to come from this. I'm curious what you think.
No, I agree with you completely. I think the NFL took a problem that could have been solved with a scalpel and they picked up a sledgehammer instead. All they needed, and this is hopefully what the solution will be come 2020, another member of the officiating crew who sits in a TV booth and somewhere in the stadium with the full uniform on. Make this person part of the crew and give that person a pipeline directly to the referee so that person sees what we see at home and that person can close the gap between what the officials are trying to process in real time with the naked eye while they're trying, number one, to stay alive. And when there is a mistake like that, boom, you talk to the referee, no different than a conference of officials that we see on the field, and you clean it up in real time, not as part of the replay process, but part of the overall officiating process. Officiate from a TV screen in the stadium. That would have fixed this problem, and that would be the fail-safe when there is this once every 50 years situation where it's blatant pass interference that no one bothered to drop a flag for. This new replay review for pass interference, I agree with you. Look, this is subjective decision-making, and for subjective decision-making to be overturned, I think the bar needs to be ridiculously high, and that's what I hope Al Riveron ultimately does. But we saw a couple of years ago, you know, his struggles with catch, no catch. He took away the Zach Miller touchdown when there was no basis for taking it away. Mm. He had a lot of struggles that year determining what was and wasn't a catch, and I think it's going to get even harder determining what is and what isn't interference, and it takes a long time. The calls that I saw in that Chiefs-Bengals game, it was a long delay, and it really does disrupt the flow of the game.
He's Mike Florio joining us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford, 500 new and used vehicles to choose from. Before we let you go, Mike, I am fascinated with the quarterback situation in New York, whether it's Eli or Daniel Jones. We had the owner, John Mara, come out and say that he hopes that Daniel Jones doesn't play at all in his coming season. How many other Giants employees are with the owner of the franchise?
Yeah, and I don't think that's a good outcome. If Eli Manning starts every game and this team contends for the postseason, what do you do in 2020? Do you bring Eli Manning back again? Do you just cling to him until the wheels fall off? And when John Mara also said that this team needed dramatic and drastic changes and they got rid of Odell Beckham Jr., Olivier Vernon, and Landon Collins, why are you clinging to Eli Manning? There's this weird dynamic among owners, I think. Not all of them, but some. When they've got a franchise quarterback, it's like a trophy, and we can't let this guy go. And there is a sentimentality that creeps into it. Mara was asked about that last season, and he got upset, which tells me that whoever was asking him the question was onto something. That I think that they blur the line between employee and surrogate son with some of these franchise quarterbacks, and Mara can't find it in his heart to move on from a guy that delivered two Super Bowl championships to the New York Giants.
Mike, one other one I got to get your take on, because we've got a lot of Packer fans here, even though it's Chicago, the rivalry, the whole thing, and I'm just fascinated by this. I mean, I've talked to Aaron Rodgers. You've talked to Aaron Rodgers. He's not Lucifer. I mean, he's not the worst person in the world. He's a strange dude, and he seems to have set out in training camp to prove that he is going to treat Matt LaFleur the exact same way he allegedly treated Mike McCarthy. And it just doesn't feel like there's a lot of good things happening up in Green Bay right now.
Now, my take on Aaron Rodgers is he likes to engage in casual drive-by criticism of authority figures in the Packers in a way that isn't obvious. And when someone says, hey, you just criticized Matt LaFleur by saying what you said, he gets upset. He says fake news. He says clickbait. That's what he's been doing all week. He's been referring to any stories about potential disagreements with Matt LaFleur's offense or the joint practices with the Texans, anything. He calls it clickbait. And he needs to realize that there are procedures and protocols. If you have concerns about whether or not you have the freedom of the line of scrimmage to call audibles, whether or not you like the fact that there's live special teams drills at joint practices, you go to the coach's office and you sit down in the chair and you talk to him about it there. You don't talk about these things publicly. There's no coach of any sport at any level that would be happy with a key player talking publicly about things that should stay within the walls of the organization. Now, it's good for our business that he does it, but it's like he doesn't understand the connection between talking about these things and inviting the criticism, and he doesn't want the criticism, and he gets upset when he gets criticized because, as we know, he is so sensitive that he's sensitive about being called sensitive.
Well, but here's the problem we have, Mike, is that there are people close to him who think he does understand what he's doing and that he's doing it on purpose. And that's the hard part to really figure out with him.
Well, he's doing it on purpose to send a message, but he doesn't want to be called out. Mm-hmm. See, that's the key.
Yeah.
You want to be able to say something controversial that sends a message, but God forbid anyone notice it and scrutinize him and criticize him for it. You know, there's a lot of athletes that have that mindset. They want to be able to do things on their terms, and they don't want to be criticized for doing them, and they get mad. but they still want to be able to do them. And I agree with you. He's smart enough to know what he's doing. He just resents the fact that there are people who will say, hey, Aaron, we know what you're doing.
Mike, appreciate it as always. Great talking to you. We'll check in next week.
All right, see you guys.
Take care, Mike.
Mike Florio of Pro Football Talk. Hub Arkish is in for Dan Bernstein today. I'm Connor McKnight.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.